Greetings and welcome to Archive Chats, the series where we chat about all the amazing stories hidden in the archives that our LSC historians are uncovering. This second episode, titled In the Shadow of Giants, Britain, Europe and the Cold War, is with Professor Piers Ludlow, Head of Department of International History at the LSC. His research focuses on Western European history since 1945 and particularly on European integration. We hope you enjoy the episode. So let's just hop straight into it then. Our hook question for today is pretty simple. Was Europe the most important battleground of the Cold War?
Well, I think I will give a typical historian's reply to that and say, of course, it depends which part of the Cold War you're talking about. I think at the very start, it almost certainly was. Both of the emerging superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, had very Eurocentric views of the world as the Second World War came to an end. Both of them were looking very attentively at what happened in Europe, and both were extremely conscious of the huge power vacuum left by the collapse of multiple European powers, but Germany in particular. Stalin, remember, was a former revolutionary comrade of Lenin who had famously said, "He who controls Germany controls Europe." And I think there was a real sense on the part of the communists, but also on the part of the Americans, that the fate of Germany would be massively important for the fate of Europe, and the fate of Europe would in turn be incredibly important for the fate of the post-war world. So all eyes really were on Europe at the beginning of the Cold War. And I think this also reflects the fact that in a sense, the European picture seemed to be the place where the divide between, or the emerging divide between the two sides of the Cold War was most apparent. Now, of course, it takes a little while for the Cold War to emerge. There was a desire on the part of both the Soviets and the Americans, and indeed the British, to continue big three cooperation and collaboration into the post-war period. But as tensions began to mount, Europe seemed to be the obvious battleground, because it was there that the opposing armies, that the opposing occupying forces were in a sense most clearly juxtaposed one against another. Europe was divided by what Winston Churchill famously called in a speech in 1946, the Iron Curtain. And so the continent was split in half, and at its heart, Germany itself was split, well, not quite in half, but in kind of one third, two thirds. And so I think the Cold War divide in Europe was very, very obvious. Elsewhere in the very early Cold War, it was less clear cut. If one looks, for instance, at East Asia during this period, until the, in a sense, surprise outcome of the Chinese Civil War and the way in which China would tilt to the communist side, until 1949, when that happened, East Asia seemed to be much more securely in the hands of the Americans. Japan was solely occupied by the Americans. The Americans were the overwhelming military power in the region. In a sense, their position seemed unassailable. In Europe, by contrast, it was much more even Stevens. And in great power politics, if you have a situation of near parity, that can create tension, that can create a real sense of rivalry.
All right, thank you. You indeed dodged the minefield of nuance, which historians often use to navigate the Cold War, which is grand. And I think leading on to that then, we're going to delve into Europe a little bit more. We will come back to East Asia in a bit, so it's very good that you mentioned it. I think something you mentioned is the idea of great power, as of course, and the histories of the Cold War on ringed by the omnipresence of a superpower world, the US and the USSR, of course, being those two superpowers. But in the early stages of the Cold War, too, we often hear about the sort of decline of the old great powers, of course, Britain and France. Is this something which continually impacts the mentality and the policy of London and Paris, both in regards to Europe and in regards to, of course, their colonial empires and, of course, the wider non-European world in the early stages of the Cold War? Or is this very much something which we sort of apply in hindsight as looking back on the early stages of the war?
No, I think it is something that was a relevant concern at the time, although I suspect in both Paris and London there would have been a great deal of angry denial that the decline was permanent or terminal. There was a great deal of hope on both sides of the Channel that once the temporary difficulties caused by the Second World War had been recovered from, France and Britain would be able to reclaim a position on the world stage that they had previously had. So I don't think there was necessarily an acceptance of decline, but the notion of decline was very much discussed during the period. Both Britain and France hoped to use their empires to recover. Both of them were conscious that the Soviet Union and the United States were huge geographical powers, much, much larger than either metropolitan Britain or metropolitan France. And therefore, the only way in which France or Britain could compete with the two new emerging superpowers, the only way they could have any way of matching them strength for strength, would be through their colonial empires. And one of the reasons why both the British and the French were so keen to cling on to their empires, so reluctant to accept what perhaps a far-sighted person would already have been able to discern in 1945, namely that the era of colonial empires was already coming to an end. But the British and the French were desperate to resist that because they saw their empires as the only means by which they could reverse this decline and begin to operate once more at the same sort of level as these two massive new superpowers who were dominating the post-war world.
Right. So again, that's incredibly interesting because it sort of reflects the idea of empire as sort of a necessary stepping stone to ensure continued participation in the great power politics of the post-war world for both Britain and France. And it's certainly, I think we've seen that sort of scramble, or at least to prevent the decline of empire and the decline of great power status, of course, with Suez for the British and to a lesser extent Algeria as well for the French and especially Indochina too. I think if we can also talk about the idea that the rest of Europe, of course, is sort of left in the lurch at the end of 1945 with death settled after the Second World War. Is there a sort of realization within Europe at large or within specific parts of Europe that they are about to become the center of attention once again for two new and emerging superpowers, of course, the US and the USSR? Or does this sort of creep up on them as the Cold War heats up in the late 1940s and into the 1950s?
I think there's fairly quickly a realization that they are at the center of world attention. It's true, of course, that the position of the Americans and the willingness of the Americans to remain engaged in post-war Europe is, I think, open to some doubt. After all, remember that the post-45 period is very much influenced by memories, which are, after all, not very old memories, of what had happened the last time Europe had come out of a major war, namely the post-1918 situation. And everybody, therefore, anybody who was my age, who was a politician, say, in their 40s or 50s, would remember very well surprise and disappointment at the manner in which America had disengaged from Europe after the First World War, refusing famously to ratify the Versailles Treaty, refusing to join the League of Nations, etc., etc. And there was therefore, I think, a degree of uncertainty as to whether the Americans might do the same thing again. There was indeed a desire on the part of the Americans, or many Americans at least, to disengage. So there was an uncertainty about that. I think on the other half of Europe, the desire of the Soviets to remain involved was in a sense rather too obvious. If you were living in Poland or Czechoslovakia or Bulgaria or whatever, the presence of Soviet troops and the extent to which the Soviets seemed intent on installing congenial leaders in the capitals of these countries was pretty evident from about 1946 onwards, indeed, probably 1945 onwards. So I think there were fewer question marks over Soviet involvement, but American involvement was a little bit more uncertain. But very quickly, the Americans begin to make their position clear. One of the big milestones, for instance, comes in September 1946, when Secretary of State Burns, the American Secretary of State, makes a very important speech in Stuttgart in Germany, where essentially he commits the Americans to rebuilding Germany. And that straight away demonstrates that America is, in a sense, committed in a way that it had not necessarily been after 1918. So that's a milestone. A few months later, you then get the Truman Doctrine, which is the moment where Truman promises to come to the aid in the short term of Turkey and Greece, but more generally any country that was struggling with outside with sort of outside destabilization, a kind of euphemism for communist subversion. And then, of course, by June 1947, you have the Marshall Plan, which is a huge commitment of American money, expertise and advice to the rebuilding of Europe. So pretty quickly, you move into a situation where the Americans are, in a sense, recommitting themselves. The Soviets are clearly committing themselves in Eastern Europe. So I don't think the power vacuum remains empty for long, although I think it is worth stressing that from a European perspective, this degree of superpower involvement is seen with a degree of ambivalence. Remember, most European powers were, in a sense, accustomed to being at the center of world politics, but as the powerful ones, not as the victims of outside power. They were the occupiers, not the occupied in normal circumstances, the colonizers rather than the colonized. And so I think there is a shock to European consciousness, suddenly to have suddenly to have not just occupation, but occupation by extra European powers in the shape of the Americans and the United States. And underneath quite a lot of the politics of the early Cold War, there is a strong bubbling up of European resentment at this outside interference, some of which I think does feed into the process that I work on particularly, namely the beginnings of the European integration process, because there's a sort of real realization that the only way in which you can sort of emancipate yourself from this outside interference is, in a sense, to become strong once more, and that one of the easier ways, well, easy was perhaps the wrong word, but one of the ways of recapturing some of your former strength, particularly when facing such colossal adversaries, is to cooperate more tightly with one another.
Right. So, yes, I think that's definitely a logical stepping stone for the European powers to have. I'm particularly sort of interested and amused by the fact that they have this psychological shock of having the roles reversed. They're the ones who usually are the colonizers, and now they're the ones being occupied and somewhat influenced to a rather significant degree by extra-European powers. And one can only imagine that the subsequent extra-European movements in the empire for independence and the overthrowing of various European colonial governments across the world only added to that shock as well. Yeah. I'm also reminded of a rather nice truism, which is a bit more modern in its origin, but with regards to the, at least the Eastern Europeans at the immediate end of the Second World War, with the Red Army, of course, occupying many of their capitals and Stalin looking on to create them as buffer states as early as 1946. And that truism is that Washington is far and Moscow is near, which is, of course, the fact that the reality on the ground is that the Soviets are the ones with the upper hand and the Americans are the ones who are, as you say, unsure of whether or not they will be willing to commit to staying on the ground or if they should pull out and withdraw as they did at the end of the First World War several decades earlier. And I think then we can then move on to that area which you mentioned, which is, of course, the rise of the sort of inter-European blocs, NATO, of course, the Warsaw Pact, and what would later become the EU as we know it today. Were these sort of deliberate attempts to unite against the superpowers, or were they much more sort of influenced by a desire to cooperate with the superpowers but avoid being influenced by them to an undesirable extent?
Well, I think sort of it's important to stress from the start that America is deeply involved, most obviously, in the creation of NATO, which is an American-led alliance, albeit one that where a lot of the effort to draw the Americans in was contrived by European leaders, not least the British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin. There's the Norwegian historian Guy Lundestad came up with a famous phrase about this being an empire by invitation, and he was thinking very much of NATO when he's talking about this. So I don't want to over sort of, I despite the point I was making about sort of resentment, I don't want to give the impression that American involvement is wholly unwelcome. It's welcome. American money is welcome. American security pledges are welcome. But there is an ambivalence. The Europeans, in a sense, know that they need this in the short term. They certainly need the money. By the time you get to 1948, 49, they feel that they need the security commitment also. But it takes a sort of degree of reluctance. It's sort of they really don't want, in a way, they don't want to have to be, invite the Americans in, but the circumstances in which they find themselves compels them to do so. Just as there's a little bit of reluctance on the American side, they're not certain they want to commit to European security for the long term. And it's worth remembering, of course, that NATO is signed initially as a 20-year treaty. The fact that we're now, or whatever we are, 1949, so we're sort of 52 years on, that would, or 62, that would be a shock to all of the signatories that the NATO alliance is at a going concern so long after its signature. So it's not meant to be a commitment in perpetuity. And there is a degree of ambivalence and misgivings on either side, but there is also a sense of necessity. NATO is seen as a necessary commitment for both sides in those contexts. European integration is slightly different. That is more of a European-driven process, but it is a European-driven process for which the Americans are deeply supportive. And I think you can make a strong case that actually without American support, it would certainly have been more difficult and possibly impossible to get it off the ground in the first place. If you look at its underlying origins, it is something that some European politicians, thinkers, statesmen have been talking about, writing about, thinking about, even proposing for many, many years. The French famously put forward the Briand Plan in 1929-30. So this is not a new idea. It's something that was extensively discussed amongst resistance groups and other things during the Second World War itself. So it's in the air. American support, however, is very, very useful in the early stages, partly because the Americans have money, partly because the Americans are powerful, partly because the Americans can, in a sense, provide a shield, which not only shelters the emerging Europe from the Soviet threat, but it also shelters Europe in at least two other ways. One of those ways is that it shelters it from Britain. The British are very ambivalent. Now, here's a surprise about the European integration process in its early stages. They're not at all certain that they approve or like the process. And there are various moments where the British perhaps might have been tempted to try and stick their a spanner in the works and bring the process to a halt. But the only time they actually summon up the courage to really try and do so in 1955, they are told very firmly by the Americans to stop at once. John Foster Dulles, the US Secretary of State in 1955, writes to Macmillan, the Foreign Secretary, and basically says, stop. Do not touch European integration. This is something we support, something we want. So the Americans are in a way a shield against the Brits, but they're also a shield against certain things that Europe would otherwise have had to do probably too early and might well have struggled to achieve. So if you look at what the early European community does, it essentially does trade, agriculture, not much else. It doesn't have to. Now, that's quite complicated. That's quite difficult. There's quite a lot of controversy around those. But in a way, that's kind of low policy agenda. It doesn't have to do money. There's no need to talk about a single currency early on. It doesn't have to do security. And the reason it doesn't have to do either money or security is that money and security are things that are looked after by American-led Atlantic institutions. So the Bretton Woods institutions of the International Monetary Fund, et cetera, for money, and NATO for security. And so the early integration process doesn't have to do these doesn't have to do these really complicated things because the Americans are in a sense doing it. And so that too forms a kind of shield. I've written about it elsewhere as an Atlantic cocoon within which the early integration process can start. So I think the Americans really helped. It is perhaps worth asking, well, why? Why do the Americans, well, what's in it for America? And I think the simple answer to this is, well, there are two answers. One is the Cold War. And the other is the lessons of the recent American past, recent European American past. So the Cold War, sort of the American priority in the post-war world is staying strong vis-a-vis the Soviet threat. In that context, they cannot, they realize that they need the European allies, they want a European allies, but they don't want those European allies to be squabbling too much amongst themselves, fighting amongst each other. And in particular, they don't want two of their larger allies, France and Germany, who have fought each other three times during the last previous 70 years. They don't want them having yet another round of fighting. And so their view that integration would be a way of healing that Franco-German divide, creating unity amongst Western allies, is a very important Cold War consideration. Second reason why the Americans are so keen to see Europe move in this direction, I think, is a realization again that look at America's recent past. By the sort of in 1917, again in 1941, the Americans have been drawn into European conflicts that they would much rather have stayed out of. They really don't want that to happen a third time, and therefore, for that reason too, they support the idea of a more integrated Europe. It also economically creates a more attractive market for their exporters, and it means that Europe will sort of recover economically, become strong economically, and therefore strong ally in the Cold War more quickly if it becomes a more integrated market, much more like the United States market than the separate markets that had existed within Europe earlier.
Indeed. I think two things mainly stood out there. The first, which was more recently said, was the idea of this sort of Franco-German cooperation of sorts within the European integration project, I believe. I read recently by another author that one of the main features of European integration was that it would bring France and Germany into an embrace that was so tight that in order for one of them to loosen their hand and punch the other, it would take too much effort, which is, I believe, accurate given the fact that they, as you mentioned, of course, have come to blows several times in the past 70 years since the beginning of the European integration project and the start of the Cold War. I think the second thing as well, which might be a bit more amusing to some listeners, given the recent roller coaster that was Brexit, is of course the British being ambivalent about a European integration. What a surprise that must have been. I think then I'd like to ask in follow-up to that is that what of course was the sort of development of the British government's opinion towards European integration? Because of course within the historiography it's often seen that Britain's foreign policy is very much a self-interested foreign policy, in that it views itself up until about, of course, the Cold War, almost in a sort of detached sense from the continent. Of course, we have the term splendid isolation to refer to Britain's foreign policy up until 1914, and even to an extent after the First World War ends with its own actions during the interwar period. How does Britain sort of view its role in Europe now? Does it view it as a sort of arbiter in the sense that it did at the beginning of the 20th century, or does it view itself now as a sort of a need to be a willing participant in the European integration projects and in the Cold War, which is of course developing in the 1950s and late 40s?
Well, I think it sees the need to be involved in the Cold War. It does not necessarily see the need to be involved in the integration process, would be the answer to that. So I think sort of it is sort of, I take the point about the importance of the kind of splendid isolation notion and the way in which the idea of Britain as a sort of disengaged power retains a degree of attraction for some British thinkers throughout sort of at multiple periods of 20th century history and into the 21st century too. But I think it would be very unfair to the British, both the post-war Labour government and then the Conservative governments that follow from 1951, to talk about that as the dominant feature. I think on the contrary, the British are very conscious that they need to be deeply engaged in the wider discussion about Europe's future. They are deeply engaged in NATO. They are deeply engaged in the Cold War West. But what they do not see the need to participate in, so initially at least, is the integration process. Now, why this differentiation? Well, I think there are several reasons for this. The first is that I think they realize that the Cold War threat is a real one, is one that they have to be deeply involved in responding to. As I said, Bevin becomes a central figure in the creation of NATO. Early post-war Britain is very sensitive to the fact that its security is wrapped up with continental Europe's security. One of the great strategic lessons of the Second World War, if you want, is that if an enemy power installs itself at Calais, etc., in a world of air power, etc., that makes Britain very vulnerable. Yes, in the end, the Channel had been enough to prevent invasion, but next time round, they might not be so lucky. And so Britain had to engage with European security, hence its role in NATO, etc. So that lesson is learned. And to be fair to the British, they remain deeply involved in European security sort of pretty much through the second half of the 20th century. Why European integration is different is, I think, a twofold answer. Well, there are lots of different dimensions to it, but I'll point to just two. The first is a political calculation. I think the British essentially see themselves still as a world power. They see themselves perhaps, if not quite at the top table with the superpowers, although they would like to regain that top table status, at least in a totally different league to the European powers. If I can put this in perhaps footballing terms, sort of the superpowers may be in the Champions League, but they feel themselves to be in the Premiership, whereas everybody else in Europe is in the Championship. They really don't see themselves in the same sort of power bracket as the French or the Germans or the Italians in the very early years after the Second World War. And so to accept to join into some kind of integrated structure with the Italians, the French, the Germans, etc., would be, in British eyes, a demotion. That would be to accept relegation. That would be to accept that they were at the same level as the French and the Germans, not up with the Soviets and the Americans as they hope to be. So there's a kind of status, a political argument here. There's also an economic argument. The British decide early on that their principal commercial aspirations lie beyond Europe. And they are twofold. They are firstly the development of the Empire stroke Commonwealth as a trading entity. This was a direction that the British had already begun to move during the 1930s after the Ottawa Conference, etc. And if you look at the trade figures for Britain immediately after the Second World War, nearly half of its trade is with the Commonwealth. Looking beyond the Commonwealth, they also have aspirations to the American market. Eventually, they would like to do more business with the Americans. I think I've heard that before. Sort of Liz Truss surely said something about that. But I will stop making Brexit parallels in a moment. But nevertheless, there is an aspiration to get to the American market also. The European market does not initially seem very attractive. Partly because the European market is regarded as one that essentially produces very similar to stuff to the British. And the British make what turns out to be actually a miscalculation about the way in which prosperity will be secured in post-1945 world trade. They essentially make a calculation that the big sort of way in which you're going to make money is going to be sort of north-south trade between the developing world and the developed world, so industrialized goods moving from the north to the south and agricultural and other goods moving in the opposite direction. Trading with Europe doesn't make sense if you think that's where you're going to make your money. Now, it actually turns out that the post-war, post-1945 economic boom is actually made primarily by industrialized powers trading with each other. You don't make your money by selling sort of cars to Africa and buying tropical produce, bananas, cocoa, coffee, whatever from Africa. You make your money much more by selling cars to the Germans and buying their cars. And that's actually how the post-war boom happens. But the British make the wrong call there. They think that these complementary relationships with the global south, as we would now say it, are going to be more economically advantageous, whereas a competitive relationship with competitor economies in Europe is not seen as a thing. So there's both a kind of economic calculation and a political calculation. And in both of them, initially point Britain very clearly away from European integration. And as a result, the British are, in a sense, they have two positions. As I said, there are occasional moments where they think, oh, wait, okay, let's actually try and stop this process. But to be fair, that is a minority moment. There are very relatively few moments where that prevails. Most of the time, the British actually say, yeah, fine, integration's great for you. It's great for France. It's great for Germany. Go for it. But just doesn't involve us. The historians sometimes talk about benevolent detachment during this period, or benevolent neutrality. In other words, the British are a bit like one of those kind of parents on the sideline of a children's football match on a cold sort of winter morning. And they're like, come on, go for it! Sort of clapping their hands and encouraging the kids onwards. They're not going to run. They're not going to get involved. They're too big for that kind of game. But they nevertheless are encouraging the others forward. And that's a little bit what the British act like in the early stages of the integration process.
Right. I think on that note, we can definitely cease with the Brexit parallels, but I think we would love it if the football parallels continued in the metaphors there. That was absolutely fantastic, I think. So it's interesting, I think, in a way that British, the way that they initially view where economic success is going to come from in the post-war world almost certainly has similarities to how they viewed economic success in the imperial age, the idea of importing raw produce and agricultural foodstuffs from their colonies and then exporting back to them the produced goods and the industrialized materials, of course, which sustained their empire pretty much until, of course, the decolonization period. And I think then with this sort of expansion of markets, it's fair we should move towards an expansion of the sort of the battlegrounds of the Cold War, which we mentioned at the beginning. Of course, at the early stages of the Cold War, from 1945 to about 1949, historians often focus mainly on the European theater, so to speak, on the developments within Europe, rightly so, right, because there are indeed, as we've touched on, many developments within Europe at that time. But in 1949, with the victory of the communists in China over the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, and the proclamation of a People's Republic of China, and then of course in 1950 and to 53 with the Korean War, we see this sort of expansion of the Cold War. How does this expansion then influence Europe's relative importance to the superpowers? Because of course, it is a general assumption, I would say, within the popular conscience, to assume that up until these two major events, the communist victory and the Korean War, Asia sort of occupies a periphery, a spot on the periphery of the foreign policy of America and the Soviet Union. Does the focus then shift towards Asia, whereas Europe is then sidelined to the periphery? Or is there a sort of more nuanced and complex relationship between the two areas where the Cold War is now beginning to sort of heat up and rage on?
I don't think it's a good question, and I don't think it's a total reversal, but there's certainly movement in the direction that you indicate. So from about 1949 onwards, I think you're right that attention does begin to tilt towards East Asia and away from Europe. And in part, at least in Cold War terms, that reflects the fact that by 1949, the European front, if you want, is stabilizing, is rigidifying, and there's little scope for movement either way. Now, it's true that there's a little bit of uncertainty still. The position of countries like Austria and Finland and so on is not entirely clear cut at this point. But the division of Germany in 1949, the emergence in that year of both West Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, and a German Democratic Republic, East Germany, that kind of means that the central prize in the European Cold War it has in a sense been denied to either side, or at least one side has grabbed 2/3 and the other side has grabbed 1/3. And although tension will remain and will, of course, persist until the end of the Cold War, in a way that has been kind of rigidified by that stage. And so you perhaps switch of attention is partly the threat that in East Asia, there's a little bit more movement, or at least there seems to be some possibility of change, particularly with the surprise outcome of the Chinese Civil War. So it's partly that. But the reason I say don't sort of overdo the change is the way in which I'm always surprised as a Europeanist at the impact that the Korean War has on Europe. With the Korean War, you do see the first armed conflict of the Cold War taking place in East Asia, not in Europe. So there is a clear shift in attention. But what is surprising is the degree to which both the Soviet Union and the Americans and all the European capitals react to events in East Asia by initially perhaps hesitating to believe that this really is the main story. Both the Americans and many of the European powers react to the North Korean invasion, which they assume is Soviet-backed and Soviet-instigated. Of course, we now know that it's actually much more to do with Kim Il-sung's own desire to invade South Korea. But nevertheless, the assumption in the Western side is that the Soviets are calling the shots here. They are saying attack, and therefore the North Koreans are doing as the Soviets tell them to. But the assumption is that this must be the dress rehearsal for the main act, which is going to follow when that other divided country, namely Germany, sees an invasion from East Germany of the West. And so one of the American responses to the invasion of Korea, of course, it is partly to move lots of troops to Korea and to fight the Korean War that ensues. But one of their other reactions is to strengthen NATO. Is to push the issue of German rearmament, for instance, the question of whether you should once more turn Germany into a combatant. So Germany had been disarmed at the end of the Second World War. Should you once more rearm Germany? This is one of the big controversies in European politics during the 1940s. The Americans decide that they're going to do so, and they really need to do so urgently once the Korean War happens, partly, of course, because they have to shift some troops from Europe to Germany, but also from Europe to Korea, but also because they realize that this might well be a prelude to a similar Soviet incursion in the European theater. So there is a rather kind of bizarre European-centered reaction to an East Asian event, which is why I don't think there's an immediate flip of the focus, or at least a complete flip. But I take your general point that as you move into the 1950s and then 60s and so on, Europe's centrality to the Cold War divide will begin to lessen. And I think if you look at some of the latter stages of the Cold War, the 70s and the 80s, I think you can make a case that the principal moments, or even the 60s, the principal areas of tension, the principal sort of loci of conflict are in the Global South. They're in Vietnam, they're in Africa, they're in later on in Latin America, etc. And that's where the tension is, whereas the European front is in a way solidified occupied and immobile. And yes, there were momentary tensions over the Berlin Wall or whatever, but actually there's no movement either side, and therefore the level of tension is lower.
I think that's certainly an argument that a fair few historians would definitely make, and one that I could definitely see gaining a fair bit of traction. I think then, moving alongside the fact that we've expanded the geographical scope of our discussion on the development of the Cold War, let's move a little bit forward in the time frame wise. I think a lot of Cold War history centers around the centrality of leaders of the major powers. Of course, you have the American presidents, the Soviet premiers, and to a lesser extent, but perhaps not to the same level as the European leaders, the British prime ministers of the age, of course. I think a lot of the attention, especially within popular history and within the media, has been about the idea of great individuals and the great connections between them that facilitated a degree of cooperation within the Cold War when it might not otherwise have been possible or indeed expected. Of course, Churchill and Stalin come to mind cooperating during the Second World War, and of course, Thatcher and Gorbachev in an extent during the latter half of the Cold War. I think one sort of transition of leadership, which is less looked into, and do feel free to correct me on this, is what happens in both the British and American circles, and indeed the European circles, when Stalin dies, because of course there is no, I believe, no major certainty over who will succeed Stalin. Certainly, even within the Soviet Union, there is no certainty of who will succeed the Man of Steel himself. So what happens when Stalin dies in that sort of interesting interregnum period before Malenkov and Khrushchev sort of solidified their power in succession to each other? Is there sort of a shift within the European perspective, or is there a sort of hesitance or ambivalence indeed within their policies?
I think sort of hesitancy and ambivalence is probably a good way of putting it. I think there's profound uncertainty. It's sometimes argued that this is a missed opportunity, that there was a chance of getting out of the Cold War in 1953 when Stalin dies. Stalin's personality, Stalin's policies, Stalin's sort of paranoid worldview had very much been central to the early Cold War. And therefore, when he dies, particularly as he's not immediately followed by a strong successor, that does, in the eyes of some, create a momentary window where perhaps some degree of progress towards overcoming the Cold War divide might have been made. Now, to be honest, I don't really buy that. I think at this stage, there is still too much vitality and vibrancy and confidence on the part of Soviet ideology for that really to be likely. So the Soviets are not the death of Stalin may make precise Soviet Cold War policy flex, but in many ways the Soviets remain equally convinced that they are going to win the Cold War and equally determined therefore to push ahead in policies that the West would see as aggressive and therefore would need to respond to, as Stalin had been himself. And so I don't actually see there being a huge missed opportunity there. But there is certainly a change, and there is also a degree of mystification, and there is this kind of bizarre period where there is this struggle for power going on in Moscow, and as part of that struggle for power, a series of sort of quite radical Cold War reform ideas are floating around. So, for instance, Beria, who is fairly quickly got rid of, but the former head of Stalin's secret police, and the last Soviet sort of key Soviet figure to be liquidated by his rivals because he's regarded as so dangerous that he will shoot them if they don't shoot him. But Beria has all sorts of radical ideas about changing Soviet policy towards Germany, which then are kind of semi-picked up by some of his successors. So there are some interesting ideas going around at that stage, and there is a moment of flex, if you want, in Soviet policy. But I think it would be wrong to see this as a major missed opportunity to actually end the Cold War. But it is, you're right, a key moment.
Yeah, I think the idea of it being a major moment to end the Cold War isn't quite as convincing in the way you've certainly laid it out to be. Certainly, there are still very much differences, major differences within the stances of both superpowers and the European community at large, even after Stalin's death. And even though the Soviet policy does flex a little bit, I think it's fair to say that by 1956, with the crushing of the Hungarian Revolution and policy and the reaction to the Suez Crisis from Khrushchev's government, the West is fairly reassured that the Soviets are still sticking to a fairly strong, perhaps not as transparent policy as maybe Stalin stuck to, but certainly one which retains control of Eastern Europe and one which sees Europe as a battleground which will continue for the near foreseeable future under Khrushchev's administration and leadership. I think then moving back, if we could, to Western Europe for a bit, specifically with Britain, and to looking to the other side of the pond, so to speak, a major sort of narrative within the historiography is also this idea of a sort of special relationship between Britain and America, which develops during the Cold War, and indeed is probably is you could make the case is a product of the cooperation between the two powers during the Second World War. Is the special relationship really as special as perhaps some people would assume it to be, or is there an interesting sort of are there any interesting moments where the relationship appears to be nothing more than just the simple fact that these two powers are working together? Because of course there are instances where their policies do differ from one another.
I think sort of the special relationship is much talked about, and I sometimes feel is somewhat overemphasized and sort of over idolized. It does matter. It clearly matters. Any country's relationship with the most, so any Western country's relationship with the Western superpower is vitally important. But the British can, with some justification, claim to have carved themselves out a particular role vis-a-vis the Americans. And they have a number of major advantages on which they can play when interacting with Washington. The sort of deep relationships and bonds that have been formed during the Second World War itself. It's worth remembering that right up until the Kennedy period, you have people who fought together in the Second World War, who had cooperated very closely together in the Second World War on in both London and Washington, in power in both London and Washington, and therefore those relationships that provides a kind of human capital that is playable on. But there are also more basic factors, the shared language, for all the quips about countries divided by a common language, does matter. It gives British politicians an ability to insert themselves into American domestic politics in a way that is much harder for any continental European rivals to emulate. So I think there is something there. There's also a shared intelligence relationship, which again goes back to the Second World War, but which will run like a spine through this period, and something that my colleague Matthew Jones could talk endlessly about, namely the shared nuclear relationship, is also important. Now, that's a very unequal relationship. The nuclear relationship, in a sense, captures the inequality, the asymmetry of the special relationship, in that what the British are accepting is American assistance on terms that make them utterly dependent on American, on ongoing American goodwill. They take a very different, so this is a contrasts very strongly with the French approach to nuclear weapons, which is essentially that we have to develop these things ourselves. It will cost us more, it will be harder work, and in the end, we may get much less bang for our buck, but we will be truly independent. Whereas the British decide that we will cooperate very tightly with the Americans, we will allow ourselves to become dependent on their technology. This will save us money, this will save us time, this will mean that we can have bigger, better, shinier nukes. But at the same time, it's going to mean that we have to stay very close to Washington, because next time we need to replace them, we don't have the technology to do it ourselves. We need them to sell us the latest kit that they will. So there are sort of pillars that really do make that relationship special. But there, it is also a very it, it sort of it becomes a cliche in European in British politics, because every British prime minister, every British leader wants to be seen as being close to the Americans, wants to be have photographs of them in the Oval Office or Camp David with the US president or whatever it is, given wide circulation. There is this custom of going very early on when you become British Prime Minister, you travel to Washington pretty immediately so as to be seen there, etc. And the British press will spend acres and acres of newsprint speculating about the ups and downs of personal relationships, sort of is the American president snubbing the British prime minister, etc. Now, all countries in the Cold War context care about their relationship with the superpower. So you would find stuff in the French media, you would find stuff in the Italian media, you would find stuff in the German media about their leaders' relationships with the person in the White House. And as, of course, we've all been reminded during the Trump period, when you have somebody in the White House who is problematic, who is difficult, who is unpredictable, this can create a lot of uncertainty and anxiety in Europe. And of course, it was much more so during the Cold War period. So this is not utterly unique, but it does become a particular British obsession, because this is so much seen as being the centerpiece of British foreign policy, Britain's sort of real calling card. And of course, it becomes more so once Britain's alternative routes to greatness, like the empire, fall away.
Yeah, so I think, well, firstly, minor warning to listeners, we'd like to stress that the Beaver podcast is an apolitical organization, and we don't endorse any condemnation or condoning of policies by current leaders or possibly past leaders. But I think it's interesting to that sometimes the media views this, portrays this sort of special relationship with the assumption that Britain and the US are always on equal footing. And as you've very well pointed out, it's very much not the case in certain aspects of the cooperation during the Cold War. In fact, I'm reminded of one of the cynical realities of a relationship between two countries is that one of them is usually the dominant one and one of them is usually the one which has to follow the lead of the dominant one. And it certainly appears to be like that at times. Certainly, there are, of course, shared pillars, and there is a need to an importance which all European countries and all countries, I think, in the Cold War afford to the relationship with whoever is in the White House and whoever is in power in Washington, just as they would accord it to the relationship with the Soviet Union, whoever's in the Kremlin at the time. And I think as well, there's this idea that the special relationship is one of the unique sort of international relations between two countries, perhaps isn't quite so true, but certainly it is an interesting thing to look at further within the Cold War. So I think to follow on from that, there's this interesting tidbit which you mentioned earlier was the experience of the European countries, which we don't always associate with narratives of the Cold War, namely the Scandinavian countries, and to a lesser extent, perhaps the southern European countries, perhaps Italy, Greece, and to an extent Spain. I was wondering if you could perhaps expand on how these countries experienced European integration and how they viewed the Cold War as a whole, from the start to finish, if possible, or indeed at least from the very start of it.
Well, in a sense, both groups have very, very different experiences from one another and within those groups. So within the Scandinavian, within Scandinavia, you have neutrals like Sweden and Finland, although whether Finland is part of Scandinavia is a debate I don't want to get into. But then you have NATO members like Denmark and Norway. So their experience of the Cold War is, in a sense, rather different. And that partly relates to the way in which their experience of European integration is also very different. Denmark is a country that will join along with Britain in 1973. So it's one of the first wave of enlargements. The Swedes and the Finns will only join in the mid-1990s, in 1995. And the Norwegians, of course, famously have twice applied for membership, twice negotiated membership, and then twice rejected membership in a referendum campaign. I always joke to my students in my European integration history class that if you want low job satisfaction, become a Norwegian EU negotiator, because you spend months and months negotiating a deal and then only to see your voters reject it. So there within Scandinavia, there's therefore a very, very different situation. If you look at if you turn your gaze south, there too, there is a huge study in contrast. You have something like Italy, which is a founder member of NATO, a founder member of the European Community. But you also then have a country like Spain, which up until the 1970s is, of course, an authoritarian dictatorship. And although it is able to form a security relationship with the United States and therefore should probably be seen as part of the Cold War West, it's not a member of NATO and it's not a member of the European integration process until it joins in 1986. Portugal, likewise, is an authoritarian regime until the 1970s. So there are big differences within those regions. But it's true that both the security Cold War and the integration process matter quite a lot in these regions. At various points of the Cold War, the Mediterranean is very much at the heart of Cold War tension. This will be particularly so early on with the Truman Doctrine is after all triggered by instability in Greece, civil war in Greece indeed, and tension in Turkey. But again, it will be the case in the 1970s. In the 1970s, there's a real anxiety on the part of the Americans that this whole region could potentially sort of fall into the communist lap. You've got a very volatile situation in Greece following the end of the colonel's regime there, and there's a period of uncertainty. You've got uncertainty in Portugal after the Carnation Revolution. You've got very high levels of communist support in Italy, and the Communist Party is kind of possibly entering into government. In the end, it doesn't, but there's a kind of moment of uncertainty. And you've got the big question mark over what happens to Spain after Franco dies. And so there is a huge, and then throw in Yugoslavia as well as Tito reaches the end of his life. You've got a whole area of instability in Southern Europe during that period of the Cold War. So it becomes a really crucial arena at times, but it's one that it's difficult to generalize about because the starting position of the component parts are in a sense so different from one another. Likewise, Northern Europe is at times quite important, although perhaps it's strategically sensitive because of course the Soviet Union Norway is one of the few NATO members to have a direct border to the Soviet Union, so that makes it unusual. There is a degree of strategic sensitivity there. It's perhaps slightly less unstable than Southern Europe at times becomes.
I think certainly it's interesting to note how, that the experiences and the starting points of these countries are different. So, of course, generalizations are hard. Generalizations in general are not something the historical profession looks fondly upon, but I think it's certainly in this case, it's even less possible to draw big generalizations as a whole. Now, I think then something that which you've also mentioned and alluded to is this idea of expanding the European integration, the scope of European integration. Certainly we've been seeing it recently in our own worlds with the recent Russian aggressions in various parts of NATO community members and the idea of expanding NATO recently. Was this something that the European leaders at the time of the Cold War were aware of or indeed open to the idea of? Because, of course, we mustn't forget that alongside NATO and what would later become the EU, we had the Soviet and Eastern European counterparts, the Warsaw Pact and the various administrative bodies there. Was there ever a sort of desire, or indeed from the beginning, within Europe to expand eventually in the foreseeable future with Soviet assent or even cooperation to Eastern Europe and to expand membership so that the European continent could sort of become one large community rather than two semi-jointed communities?
I think sort of what might be called a pan-European vision, in other words, a vision of Europe East and West, is one of the very early casualties of the Second World, of the Cold War. There are people who come out of the Second World War really hoping that these notions of European unity, which I talked about as having bubbled up from sort of and being quite sort of dynamic and active and well widespread during the Second World War itself, there was a real hope that this might be realizable on a pan-European scale during the Second World War and perhaps in the immediate aftermath. But pretty quickly, it becomes clear that the Soviets are not going to play ball. They're not going to allow this. There's therefore no scope at all for countries under sort of Soviet satellite countries to cooperate in the to participate in the integration process. And so, in a way, that whole possibility is shut down for the duration of the Cold War. One of the reasons why the slogan, the return to Europe, will become so central to the 1989 revolutions and the transformation of Eastern Europe at the end of the Cold War is precisely that Eastern European countries or the dissidents within them, the leaders of the revolutions, are conscious of having been, in a sense, cut off from the rest of Europe by the Iron Curtain, prevented from participating in the integration process, and that they're therefore very keen to return to Europe, as the slogan puts it, and participate once Soviet rule has been overthrown. But during the Cold War, that's not really an option. The issue of European EEC enlargement is a little bit more possible, but there it's to do with, in a sense, Western unity in a Cold War context. There is an argument, and this is something, for instance, the British are quite keen to argue in the late 50s, early 60s, that would argue that there is a problem with European integration in that it actually divides the West. Particularly once you move into the 1960s, where Western Europe is divided into two competing trade blocs. One of them, the EEC, which will eventually become the EU, the other, the British-led European Free Trade Association, EFTA. This division between the six and the seven, as they were sometimes called, because one has six members, the early community, and EFTA has seven, that division is seen by some as a potential weakening factor in the Cold War. And therefore, there are people who will argue that Western Europe needs to unite, the community needs to enlarge, these separate bodies need to be brought together, precisely so that there isn't a divide between them that the Soviets can play upon and exploit and use to weaken the West in the Cold War. So the whole issue of kind of EU enlargement, as we now put it, sort of is an issue at that period, but we're talking about within Western Europe. So the potential new member states are Britain, they're Denmark, they're possibly Sweden, possibly Norway rather, later on Greece, Portugal, Spain, as they emerge from authoritarian rule. Those are the candidate countries. Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, etc., that's beyond the imaginable while the Cold War continues. Although as soon as the Cold War ends, then suddenly people can start talking about those countries too being brought into the process.
Well, I think to end on that note, I think certainly one of the things we've learned from this interview, alongside many, many things, is the idea that Europe's experience of the Cold War is very much one of cooperation in an atmosphere of uncertainty and ambivalence at times, especially with regards both to the superpowers and in regards to other European member states as well. Thank you so much for your time, Professor. I hope to see you, and I hope our listeners will hope to see you on future episodes of the podcast. If there's anything you'd like to say as a final note.
No, well, other than thank you very much. It's been interesting. Perhaps just to pick up that last idea. So I do think it's interesting, sort of, if one studies, as I do, the integration process and the interlinkages of that with the Cold War, I think it is something that is very striking for the degree of sort of rivalry and animosity that persists. This is not a process that immediately kind of eradicates problems and creates a sort of a nice harmonious agreement. Sort of to study the integration process is to study a constant process of negotiation, of battering and bruising and pushing and throwing one's weight about and so on. So it is an ongoing negotiation, and that's absolutely crucial to realize. But it is also one that takes place within a framework which perhaps limits the amount of damage or the limits the range of options open and reassures European powers about the other. And so the French and the Germans don't suddenly become absolutely bosom pals as soon as they start to integrate. But by moving their economies, by moving their, in a sense, their fortunes into a collective framework with one another, they are, in a sense, obliging themselves to go on cooperating, because the end of cooperation will be disadvantageous for both of them. And so, in a sense, you put up with the discomforts precisely because you are, in a sense, committed to this common framework. But I don't want to, in a sense, I sometimes feel that in the Britain and Europe debate, for instance, there was a perception that sort of the British were uniquely uncomfortable, that we were the only people who didn't really fit in. Well, nonsense. Actually, the whole process is about mutual scratchiness and so on. It's I won't say it's like a family life, because it makes it sound as if I'm being rude to my wife and my daughters. there is an element of kind of tension, of rivalry, of scratchiness that takes place within this context. But it does take place within a context, and the context matters. But I will end there. Right. On that theme, I could probably continue for far too long.
Perhaps we will have you back to continue on that theme, if hopefully alongside some colleagues of yours who work on similar topics. But I think I'm able to safely make the analogy that the European family is not always a cooperative and peaceful one within itself. But on that note, thank you so much, Professor. And this was the episode In the Shadow of Giants, Britain, Europe, and the Cold War. And we'll see you, listeners, soon. Thank you for listening to Archive Chats. Be sure to check out the other Beaver Sound podcasts on Spotify and all other social media. And we'll see you in the next episode.